Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi. I was away traveling for about 5 weeks from the middle of November up until the 19th of December in Israel and in Thailand. So I thought I'd speak a little bit this evening about some of the things that I was doing there and various different observations, reflections that you know, came up during that time, and also the say the different aspects of Dhamma practice and that are sort of developed and relevant in those particular countries. I was first invited to go and teach in Israel about 17 or 18 years ago, and for one reason or another, even though it was fairly thoroughly worked out and arranged, then I had to cancel the original trip, and then it's taken all this time since then for me to be able to have the time and the situation to work out for me to go back and visit there again. The two main things I was doing there, one was a non-residential retreat, a five-day retreat in Tel Aviv, and that was run by a couple, Tor and Itamar Bashan, who are very regular visitors here to Amravati. So they have a little Buddhist center in Tel Aviv, which is, Tel Aviv is the kind of cosmopolitan main city, largest city in Israel. It's fairly secular in its focus, and it's a new town, and only about 100 years old, and there's quite a number of colleges and you know, universities there, so it has quite a secular intellectual atmosphere to it, quite contrasting to say Jerusalem. And this couple, Tor and Itamar, have this Buddhist center called Bhavana House that's been established for quite a number of years there. So I'd met them here in the past, and and I'd heard the name of the center, but I was interested to see how that took shape and how that operated. When we see the name Israel in the news, then most often we're thinking of fighting, conflicts and wars and struggles of various different kinds. And that's usually what gets the headlines. And you wouldn't think of Israel as being a place that's so particularly welcoming or interested in Buddhism, you know, particularly because they have the traditions of, say, pulling down golden idols. Yeah. From the Bible, you have these strict injunctions from Jehovah saying to not worship golden idols and false gods and such like. And so there's a reticence that you could understand there being about having shrines and people chanting in Pali and or chanting at all and bowing and such like, because also there's that a custom of not bowing to other people. But to my surprise, and I'd heard a little bit of this before, I was quite startled by the extent of the interest. So this place, Bhavana House, it's very active. It is an apartment in its own right. So Tor and Itamar, they live in a different place. It's not where they lived. So the apartment is given over to the center. And it can take about 45 people in the shrine room there. And they have classes about 5 or 6 nights a week, and various different sessions, themes that they pursue, and different kinds of classes, meditation sessions that they have. So it's a very, very active center with quite a large membership, several hundred people. It's the center of their world. And it's also quite a traditional Theravada place. It really is a kind of branch of Amaravati, insofar as it's run by lay people, but they have our chanting books, and they have a shrine, and they do all the same chanting that we do here. And they're quite what you would call old school Theravadins. So that was very surprising to see the level of interest. Also, quite a range of people from different backgrounds, but almost all from the Jewish community. Amongst those interested in Buddhism in Israel, I think they have something like 97 or 98% of the people involved are from the Jewish rather than from the Palestinian community. But there are a few Palestinians interested in Buddhism as well. The extent of interest in meditation in the country is really quite enormous, and according to the statistics, of course you can't always trust statistics, but it is said that there's more people practicing Buddhist meditation per capita, so of the people in Israel, than any other country in Europe. So out of the whole population of Israel, of 8 million people, you have something like 80,000 or 100,000 people who are regularly practice Buddhist meditation. So that's more than 1% of the population. So that's to me, that's quite a startling figure. That's more than what you have in Britain. And you could see also that the people who were coming along to the center had a great deal of sincerity, and also very knowledgeable. They're not just part-time practitioners, but people who not only meditate but also had studied the teachings and were very committed and involved in the study and practice of Dhamma. So that was quite startling, and also a very large proportion of young people. The majority are younger people, so either in university or just out of university. So the vast majority of people in that group would be from sort of 25 to 35, which is, again, very, very striking. It's a young and energetic crowd. We had a 5-day non-residential retreat there in Tel Aviv, and at this Bhavana House, and that was on the theme of the 7 factors of enlightenment. So we pursued that and explored that in various different ways. And then also during the days, they took me off to visit various different significant places of Israel, so that the retreat sessions and the teaching sessions were just in the evening. But you know, every day different people would come and offer breakfast or offer the meal, and Israelis are extremely keen conversationalists. So I'm known as a talker myself, but it was hard to keep up a lot of the time. And also just the level of education and general education, also knowledge of Dhamma, was really quite impressive in the people. And they would ask you quite knotty and involved questions about particular passages in different suttas, and they would often know them very, very well and be able to quote them to you. So there was a lot of sort of keen and informal teaching, but then also then during the days, they had different people would take me off to different local sites, like to Jaffa, which is adjoins, which is the ancient seaport which adjoins Tel Aviv, and then also to Haifa, where it's the site of Mount Carmel, and to Jerusalem. And while I was there, there was this attack in a synagogue in Jerusalem, and five men were killed from an Orthodox, very sort of strict Orthodox Jewish group, were killed in the synagogue. And then the two people who attacked them were also killed, shot down by a off-duty policeman. So that all happened while I was there. And we were due to go to Jerusalem the next day. And so I discussed it with Tor and Itamar, and I felt, well, it would be quite appropriate. Best thing to do would be to not cancel the trip, even though people were a bit concerned that things were could be a bit hairy and unsettled. But I thought, no, it's a good thing to do, to go and spread loving kindness and to visit the area, and to not let that event disrupt what we were thinking of doing. And so that was very interesting to go to the old city of Jerusalem. Also, growing up in England and being raised in the Church of England Christianity milieu, in that fold, I grew up hearing many, many Bible stories. So you hear these names like Jerusalem, or the place where, you know, the cave where Jesus was buried after he was crucified, or the crucifixion happening on this hill outside of Jerusalem, and the names of these different places like Mount Carmel or Jaffa or Bethesda, Mount Tabor, and so on. And then actually going to those places and seeing how they fit together, and being able to see, that's Mount Zion. Oh, that's Mount Zion right there. And then Gehenna, the gateway to hell, is right at the bottom, just below Mount Zion is the gateway to hell. It's where the prophet Jeremiah used to sort of rant and rave about the state of the youth of today and corruption in the city of Jerusalem and people behaving badly. So it was very interesting having all these names that have floated around through my childhood and my my upbringing, having places on the ground to attach them to give the mind some orientation. When we went to Jerusalem, then it was there was a certain amount of tension in the air. There was a lot, like people kept saying, well, "There's hardly any people around us. The streets are very, very empty." And it was true that mostly the only people that we saw around were Christian pilgrim groups. And a lot of people seemed to be keeping away. And there was definitely a sense of tension and a feeling that people had been up all night talking. And there's a kind of stress and weariness and agitation in the air. But we were... always, you know, treated with a lot of respect, and no one gave us a difficult time, except for at one walking along through the lanes, the bazaar in Old Jerusalem, heading down towards the place where Jesus was buried or entombed. Then this one young Muslim fellow in a shop and got into conversation with me, and he said, "Who's your God?" I said, "Well, I'm a Buddhist monk." He said, "Well, who's your God? You know, what God do you worship?" And I said, "Well, we don't really think about it in those kind of terms in Buddhism." He said, "Well, who's your God?" He wasn't going to let me, he wasn't interested in trying to let me get away from his question. And I said, "Well, I follow the teachings of the Buddha, and by following the teachings of the Buddha, that helps me to understand the truth of things. Yeah, but who's your God? Who do you bow to?" And it was clear that they said, "You should bow. You know, Allah is the one true God. Allah is the one true and the only God. And so you should you should pray to Allah. And I said, well, it's, I'm very happy that you have that faith and that commitment, but yeah, I'm a Buddhist monk. And so I could feel a certain tension rising. he was ardent and keen on his own faith, but I could see that anything I said was not going to really get through in terms of intellectual content or talking about the Buddhist approach to things. So I just with each exchange, I cranked up the sort of metta, the wattage of metta that I was putting out, the kind of cranked up the lamps and smiled at him ever more kind of brightly and in a friendly way, and so looked him right in the face with very great affection and warmth, and just kept refusing to be intimidated and just smiling and being friendly. And we got as far as, well, you're a good person, but this is wrong. have a nice. I thought, okay, that's a good finishing point. Have a nice day. May you be happy. Have a nice day, and then took off. So that was the most tense encounter that we had. But I did also notice that his shop was selling knives. So I was also quite keen not to come up with any too clever or contentious remarks to cause him to create any more trouble. You have these influences in Israel, the Christian, the Jewish, and the Arab worlds all come together and they interweave with each other. And so Jerusalem is a holy city for all three groups in many ways. And as I was there, I was trying to get my mind around the Jewish Palestinian questions and the picture of whose country is it, and how could they live peacefully with each other. And with each passing day, it became apparent it was more complicated than I realized. And it's so many layered, so densely layered, so intricate. It was rather, the feeling I got, it was rather like people are playing football, rugby, hockey, and cricket all on the same pitch at the same time. You got all these different sets of rules and realities all kind of overlapping with each other. And it's like, well, which ball? Should I have a stick here, or do I pick up the ball? Do I kick it? You know, what am I supposed to do here? there's so many different sets of priorities and practicalities and influences in the mix. It was an absolutely perfect recipe for conflict and confusion. The boundary the between Israel and Jordan had been right through the middle of Jerusalem, and during the Six-Day War that got moved back out to the beyond the eastern boundary of the city, and so that Jerusalem now is the whole city is inside Israel. But the people are still, there's this invisible, what they call the green line. People are still very aware of where the green line used to be, so that there are some people who are Jewish people and Israelis who on principle won't cross the green line because they feel that Israel illegally seized the land from the Jordanians, and that they that country and that property, that land really is still theirs, and so that half of Jerusalem really should still be Jordan. And other people in the Jewish community say, no, it's our country. There's also, I discovered, a group of extremely Orthodox, hyper-Orthodox Jews who say that the state of Israel is against the law of the Bible, because there shouldn't be a state of Israel until the Messiah has come. So they are they're ardently Jewish and Zionist, but they're anti the state of Israel as it exists at the moment. So you see what I mean about complicated. Ardently Jewish, ardently Zionist, but anti the government and anti the state. And one day, there's a two of these young guys who are part of the Bhavana House group, and I said, "Are Palestinians? Do they have citizenship of Israel or not?" I thought a fairly straightforward question, and it took about 45 minutes to answer, and they couldn't agree on what the answer was, because not to go into too much detail, or if I can even remember it, but you have Israeli Jews, Israeli Christians, Israeli Arabs. You have Palestinians who are in Israel, Palestinians who are in the occupied territories. You know, Palestinians who are who are stateless, who sort of were in other territories and been moved to other parts of the country. So you have all these different layers of belonging and not belonging, and they say it can vary from one side of the street to the other. So you really began to feel great compassion for, particularly for the Palestinian community, and the terrible treatment they've been receiving from the Israeli government. And yet, you know, most of the people that you're meeting and the people that are part of the Buddhist groups there, they're mostly sympathetic with the Palestinian people and wanting them to have fair treatment. But they're also very ardently supportive of the sort of the Jewish state. So the political situation is so complicated and convoluted there, and all the religious concerns also, because the Christians feel that they've got all kinds of rights over the country as well. All the pilgrim groups visiting the Christian holy places, there's definitely a sense of ownership and propriety there, proprietary rights there. Yeah, I was reminded of a comment that Harold Macmillan, the late Prime Minister of Britain, made back in the 1950s during the Suez Crisis in 1956, when the Suez Canal had been under British governance and had been seized by the local forces, and there was this big conflict that had brewed up. And Harold Macmillan was asked by a reporter, "What's your opinion of the problem in Suez, Prime Minister?" And he, to the astonishment of the reporter, replied, "There is no problem in Suez." And the reporter said, "Oh, excuse me, sir, but this is a very strange reply, because the Arab, the Egyptian army has seized control of these ports, and they are facing off against the British. They've seized crown property, and it seems a very difficult, intense situation. So I can't see how you can say it's not a problem." And he said, very famously, "To call it a problem presumes there is a solution. There is no solution, therefore it's not a problem." So I was really sort of pushed to that same kind of appreciation, sort of moved to realize it's so complicated and so multifaceted. You can't think your way to a solution. And so also you can see that the spiritual response or the spiritual solution is so much more obvious as the way to go, because on the political and social level, it's so dense and tangled and so ancient. You know, these conflicts have been going on for thousands of years. You can see why you can see why so many people are interested in meditation, and also why people are being sort of pushed to solve those conflicts and difficulties on a spiritual level, rather than just sort of rearranging the political structures. So if you can follow that, what I mean there, that because it's so complicated at the social and political level, you have to go a whole layer deeper to get to the roots of conflict, and to get to find ways of resolving that. So that, to my surprise, there was this very widespread interest in meditation and a very strong sense of committed practice amongst people there. The second retreat that I did was at a kibbutz. A kibbutz is a kind of communal living centers that were started up from the first one was started more than 100 years ago, back in the early part of the 20th century. I think about 1905 or 1906 was the first one. And this was like a social experiment that was started by Israeli people. Even before there was the state of Israel, they launched these kibbutzes. And so they're like a village environment where there's a lot people share in the work, share in the living accommodation, and operate together as a kind of group family, as a commune. And there's one at a place called Endor, famous in the Bible is where the Witch of Endor, where I think King Saul went to consult with the oracle in Endor. And that was a retreat that was run by a group called Tovana. And Tovana is the other main Buddhist, Theravadan Buddhist group there. And that was started by a man called Stephen Fulda about 30 or 40 years ago. And there were about 70 people on the retreat, and about 50 of them were Dhamma teachers. So 50 of the people there had led local groups or gave retreats themselves, taught classes, and were not just Dhamma practitioners, but Dhamma teachers. So that gives you a bit of a sense of the extent of interest in Dhamma practice there. So it was a very rich time. They're also extremely disciplined in the retreat environment. As I said, Israeli people are very chatty, very, very talkative, but also when it's time to shut up, then they know how to be quiet. And very obedient in following the routine, and very focused on the meditation. And the theme for that was the Buddha's teachings on ultimate reality and the teachings on Nibbana. So that was 5 days on those themes there. And also to give you a sense of the kind of people that were in that group. At the end of the retreat, one woman came up to me and said, I realize you're about to leave, Ajahn, you're just going to get in the car, but I have a question I'd like to ask. Could you talk about a little bit about the connection between the conditioned and the unconditioned? Because I wrote my PhD thesis on that at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and I'd really like to know what your thoughts are on that particular aspect of things, you know, literally with my bag in my hand about to get in the car. So just a quick 2-minute response on the nature of the conditioned and the unconditioned. So and that was not completely out of the ordinary. That was the kind of level of thought and interest and sort of refinement of understanding that many of the people had. And it was very interesting to be able to speak to this group of people, 70 people on a retreat, and to refer to these very profound and significant teachings, and for them people to really understand what you're talking about. So it was very impressive in that way. I don't feel any personal mission to go and rescue Israel, so I feel far more of a commitment to Amaravati and to helping out here for the foreseeable future. But it was certainly you could see that the Dhamma teachings are very much appreciated there, and that they are hungry for the Buddha's wisdom. There's 4 bhikkhus who live there, 4 Theravadan monks living in Israel from Thailand. And I don't think there's any actual proper monasteries. There's one place that's a kind of retreat monastery that's run by a monk called Pra Ofa, who's from a disciple of Ajahn Tong in Chiang Mai, but the others are more kind of independently living bhikkhus. So in between those two retreats, then I spent a day with a family of mine that I had never met before. Again, not to go into too much detail, but my grandfather had two sisters and four brothers, and one of his brothers had three sons, Raymond, Felix, and Lucien, back in the early part of the 20th century. And they were a Jewish family from Germany, but they're very secularized and not particularly religiously observant. But one of those sons, Felix, decided he wanted to go back to his roots and got very involved in the Zionist movement and changed his name to Benjamin Ben Yosef and got on a boat, left Vienna in Austria in 1934, got on a boat and sailed across the Mediterranean and emigrated to what was then British Palestine. And he became part of the founding group of Engev Kibbutz on the Sea of Galilee. And I was trying to remember, you know, what I'd heard of him or knew about him when I was a kid growing up. And all I can remember was that Uncle Felix doesn't have much to do with the family. You know, and that was it. That's all we knew. I didn't even know he was in Israel, didn't know what he'd been doing. So last year I discovered that he had been part of this kibbutz and that the three or four generations of them still lived at the same kibbutz. So I went to go and see them and arranged a visit. And it was like a 24-hour stay, but it felt like about a month. So like completely immersed in this family history, catching up on 60 years of family history in a single day. It was very intriguing, the life of the kibbutz, because in many ways it's very like a forest monastery. And the whole wonderful dream of the kibbutz life, the idea was to be socialism with a human face. So it's based very much on communist or socialist lines. So that everything was shared, everyone worked together, everyone joined in the communal activities. There was no personally owned property. Everyone shared the buildings, and the space was communally owned. They didn't. Everyone got the same allowance. So you know, obviously, as monastics, we don't have money, but the long-term lay residents here, they get a stipend, and it's the same for everybody. And so similarly, in the kibbutz, everyone would get the same money, whether you were. Your main job was washing vegetables, or your main job was running the theater. You know, everyone got the same allowance. In the beginning, they didn't even have their own clothes. So if you had a shirt, you wore your shirt for three or four days and then took it to the laundry, then they'd give you a new shirt. And then the shirt you had been wearing would just go into the pool and someone else would get that. So you didn't even have your own clothes. Everything was communally owned. And it was very much a kind of wonderful communal spirit, and also quite courageous, because as they were establishing the particularly Engev kibbutz, so they were being as they're digging the foundations for the first buildings, they had to put up bulletproof walls to stop them being shot at from the Syrian people up on the Golan Heights. So it's hard enough. Doing construction work in the first place, you know, digging foundations, but if you're being shot at the same time, you realize that these people really meant business when they were establishing their communities. So it was quite marvelous to see that this kind of wonderful, crazy dream that they had, and also that it was very non-religious. It was not based on Judaism at all. It was very much a social experiment and on secular principles, largely on sort of socialist principles. And the big topic of conversation was that everything is eroding. So about 70 years after the foundation of this kibbutz and all through Israel, the kibbutz movement, everything's getting a lot more privatized. People want to have their own houses. They want to have their income according to the kind of work that they're doing. They want to own their own property, have their own things, make their own schedules. And it used to be that all the meals every day happened in the one dining hall, and then it was breakfast and lunch, and now it's just lunch, and now hardly anybody even shows up for the communal lunch in the dining hall. everywhere. And so this sense of things being privatized and the old communal spirit eroding. So that was the big topic of conversation and being spoken about everywhere. In a sense of, it was very poignant, really. This cousin of mine, Yoel, who was sort of looking after me and showing me around. And he was born on the, and he and his brothers were born on the kibbutz. They lived their whole lives there. He's in his mid-60s now. Born there, grew up there, lived there, worked there every day of his life. And he said, 70 years and it's all broken. So there was a sadness there that way of life was disappearing and dissolving, but also that within the next generation there's a whole fairly substantial movement of people who are sort of starting up a new kind of kibbutz movement in the cities, whereby they're using smaller groups of people living communally and sharing income and sharing the facilities, but more based around education and that kind of thing, so that they're sort of revitalizing that spirit. So that was a kind of interesting experience of going from a vague idea. I think I had an Uncle Felix somewhere, a year and a half ago, and then entering into that world and discovering this whole universe of the kibbutznik life, and also just a sense of how close in spirit it was to the monastic life, but also many wonderful human values, but without the focus on the spiritual training and mind training, how you could see how it had really, it was no surprise that it had become more based on self-concern and people just wanting to look after their own kids, their own families and their own things. Because originally the children were not brought up with the family, so there was children's houses. So if you had three kids, you'd see them for an hour a day. They'd be living in the children's house, and they'd be playing and studying there and having their schooling there. The children didn't live with their parents, even. So even families were raised communally. So that was quite interesting to see the contrast between the spiritual emphasis on monastery and the focus on mind training, and how that helps things to stay far more focused and clear and principle, and that those values in many respects get stronger over the years, and how that with the kibbutz movement, even though it was a sort of wonderful idealistic dream, without that element of mind training and understanding the habits of self-view and greed, hatred, and delusion, that slowly that ideal has sort of lost its basis and can't sustain itself in such a complete way. So then I went to Thailand and I was mostly giving Dhamma talks in Bangkok and Chiang Mai. That was the main part of my visit there. But the first few days, I was with my sister and her husband, and she turned 60 and he turned 70 this year. And so some time back, these friends of ours, Jung and Songkran, they have this absolutely beautiful resort on the southern tip of Phuket Island. Said, please, 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 anytime you have any family members you want to bring here, we're very happy to put them up. If they want to bring them to Sipanwa, please just let us know. So as my sister was turning 60 and her husband was turning 70, I thought, well, maybe I could. And they've been trying to visit Thailand for many years. They've made three attempts already, and it didn't work out. So I thought, maybe if they get to Thailand this time, I can take them to Sipanwa. And marvelously, it came together. So that was, I felt intense mudita for these, because Sipanwa is a very, very beautiful location. It's on the sort of craggy, rocky tip of the southern part of the island, and you have views out over the Gulf of Thailand on one side and out towards the Andaman Sea on the other. And each of the cabins or villas has its own infinity pool. So you can literally step out of your room into the pool, into your own private pool, and look out over the ocean as you're swimming about in your little pool. So it's pretty fancy. And so there's absolutely no way that they would ever pay that kind of money that it costs to stay there. So they were in a state of wonderment, a kind of continual wow. And also just the our friends, Jung and her husband and the staff there were bending over backwards to look after us all so well. So it was really lovely to be able to see that, living in a luxurious place like that. Personally, I can only be comfortable there for about 2 or 3 days, and then it gets to be a bit too much paradise. And you're looking more forward for looking towards a few more kind of crunchy bits to be life more in a more of a normal fashion. But it was lovely, just for a few days, to be able to help them to experience that and to have that flavor of Thailand. Also, my sister getting a sense of her little brother is not. It's not just her little brother. And she said, they're very respectful towards you, aren't they? Said, well, yeah, I've been a monk for quite a long time. Said, yeah, but I mean, they're down on their hands and knees all the time, Yeah, well, that kind of goes with the job. So it was very, very sweet, and they were extremely appreciative. So part of the talks that I was invited to give, as people might know, again, on back to the subject of politics, dense and complicated politics. One of the difficulties they've had in Thailand, they had lots of struggles between two political factions, the red shirts and the yellow shirts, and then they had a military coup a while back that then. Just took over the government, and so they're in this process of a very thorough review, and they're rewriting the constitution at the moment. And there's this many, many questions are being asked, or people are looking into how can we establish real democracy, and how can we run the country in a wholesome way, and how can we do things in ways that really help people, and how can we reshape the way we govern things, and particularly dealing with corruption and cronyism and people sort of working around the system, buying votes or getting into office because you've got a friend who is the minister's secretary and such like. And so I was invited to give a few talks to government bodies, the National Institute for Development Administration, NIDA, and the King Pujatipok Institute for Government. And the theme for those two talks was the Buddha's teachings and the modern concept of good governance and management. So I had to do some homework for that. I took my copies of Small is Beautiful and Dharmic Socialism, and the most useful book was Thanchakun Payuto's Constitution for Living, that was a very handy compendium of principles of how to live skillfully. And without going into too much detail, the people seemed to be very appreciative, and it was also, I felt a bit like, well, I'm not involved in politics, and I can't really, and I'm not an academic who studied political theory. But just saying, well, this is how we run our monasteries, and these are the kind of things that the Buddha said about how to live skillfully, how to make decisions skillfully, how to lead groups skillfully. And the main theme that I developed was that you can't possibly govern others in a skillful way until you can govern yourself in a skillful way. Which is, in a sense, it's what you call a no-brainer. if your field is meditation, and you have been watching your mind and practicing Dhamma for some years, that's a pretty obvious But it was, I felt it was a point worth making, because it was really clear that wasn't the main concern. And so in most people's minds, it's like, how can we, you know, set things up so that good government happens? But if I, as an individual, if I can't handle my own feelings of fear and aversion and greed and desire and the urges towards self-advantage, you know, wanting to benefit myself, and then if I don't understand those, or I don't know how to work with those at all, then how can I possibly help others to, you know, or lead others in ways where they can live skillfully, or where they can, you know, live in wholesome ways? If I can't even understand those forces at work within my own life, how can I possibly work and know what to do, or how to lead, and how to make skillful choices on the external level? So that was, it was an interesting themes to explore, and they seemed to be appreciative of the talks at the King Prajapati Institute. It was hard to tell whether it was that much appreciated, because people are very restrained and sort of sitting very sort of quietly and still as you're speaking. So I wasn't sure whether I was getting across or not, whether I'm making any sense at all, or people were listening. But I'm still not sure whether they were able to understand what I was saying or appreciate it. But the photo session after the talk was about an hour, and the photo session was about 20 minutes or half an hour. So the photos are about half, nearly half as long as the Dhamma talk, with everyone wanting to have their picture taken with me. So I think if that's an indication of anything, then it seemed to be that it was something that they were glad to hear. And the particular issues about they're concerned about is corruption, and how to help the society to evolve away from the corrupt modes of that have been so long established and are so common, so widespread. And one of the things that the NIDA, the National Institute for Development, they have an educational division, and I brought back a few copies. They published quite a bit of literature, and they have different educational programs trying to help work on the next generation. If this current generation is a bit of a dead loss already, it's still too far gone, to at least help the next generation to develop. And they had some very good teaching materials, and one book was an ABC on corruption, like a children's cartoon book. An ABC book on this. So B is for bribery, C is for corruption, H is for honesty, K is for kickback, you know, and then with neat little cartoons demonstrating these things. And so partly in English and partly in Thai script, but for children. I thought that was brilliantly inspired and very, very helpful. I also was in Chiang Mai. I was invited to give talks at Chiang Mai University, also at Panyaden School. Panyaden is one of the very few. There's very few Buddhist schools in Thailand. Most of the schools are secular. But Panyaden is a Buddhist school, and it's got it's only been open about 4 years, but it's a very impressive group of people. Have established that, and it's a bilingual school, so they teach both in English and in Thai. And the similar themes came up there. How do you inculcate, or how do you convey, you know, Buddhist principles to children, and how can you help them to develop wise habits and, you know, develop wholesome qualities along with the academic subjects? And one of the issues that came up there also with the talks in Bangkok was one of the big issues of today is the restlessness of children, that the children have an ever decreasing attention span, that as the level of activity and busyness and stimulation gets developed year by year, that things move faster, people have iPhones and iPads, and you can you see something, want it, get it, all within a through your iPhone in seconds. You know, it's there used to be an advert for American Express, which went, take the waiting out of wanting. You can use an American Express card, but even then you had to wait for the for the delivery. But now through the marvels of electronic marketing and electronic services, you can see something, want it, get it, and have it and be using it within seconds, just through your iPhone or your iPad. And so and then the kind of computer games and distractions and things that are there for children are increasing all the time. And so there's a general recognition that the attention span of children is, I mean, it's not just due to that, but is heavily influenced by that. So the attention span is diminishing, how long a child can stay focused on a particular task and what they need to be happening in order to keep them interested and focused is takes more and more stimulation for them to stay focused, so they get bored and restless very, very easily, and discontent. And so that was that's an issue everywhere. And there was some interesting discussions both there in Chiang Mai and also in the centers in Bangkok about what's called delayed gratification, and that how you can do something now in order to have a reward or the result later on. And it seemed that with the diminishing attention span, you want the gratification and the desire as close together as possible, so you can want get within seconds, and that if you don't get immediately, then you feel very uncomfortable and distressed. And that part of the sense of our maturing as human beings, and what in a way what the Dhamma practice is so much about, is exactly that, learning to live with delayed gratification, practicing diligently now, and then being ready to be impatient, to be uncomfortable, to have aching knees or a full bladder or an aching back, or, working with a wandering mind for hours and hours and hours, on the basis that there will be a payoff at some point in the future, that you don't have to have a pleasant result now in order for it to be worthwhile and worth doing. And so that was a regular theme, how to teach children, and also adults too, but particularly children, how to help that quality of being able to delay gratification and to be at peace with that. To be able to work hard and to train yourself and to be quite comfortable with the reward or the prize or the benefit coming after sometime considerably after. There was a famous psychology experiment done many years ago with little children. And it was a very simple task. Each child, I think they were about 4 or 5 years old, each child was told, here are two cookies, here are two biscuits. And if you, you can have one biscuit straight away. But if you wait for a minute, if you don't eat that biscuit for a minute, then you can have two biscuits. If you follow the methodology, very simple method. So you can either have one biscuit straight away, you don't have to wait, But then you don't get a second biscuit. But if you wait for a minute, then you can have two biscuits. You get two cookies. And they found that, I think it was about 10 or 15% of the children, you know, could wait. But the 85%, 90% would just go for the first biscuit and forget the second one. And then they did a follow-up study 20 years later. And the children who were the ones who would wait for the second cookie. And they had done a lot better in their lives. They were the kind of people who'd gone into long periods of university study or training courses, that they'd applied themselves at night classes, and that they had made far more secure living situations, a far better income, far better quality of work, and also work satisfaction that they had. And the people, the ones who had not been able to delay their gratification as little children, then they were working far more sort of ordinary 9-to-5 jobs. You get your pay on Friday, and there's not very much in the way of prospects for the future. But you're able to, without much training, you could do that job. You could get it straight away, and you could get the pay, but it was a kind of a job without many prospects, and was not so satisfying in many respects, more like stacking shelves in supermarkets or working in hamburger joints and such like. So this was an interesting question, and there were various different answers. I talked with Ajahn Jayasaro about this. He's been very involved with these Buddhist schools, and it's something I think it's good for all of us who are concerned about the world and the education and the next generation of people, and how to help is thinking and exploring ways to help to develop that quality, because the world is moving ever more towards restlessness and impatience, and our life in the monastery is so much around delayed gratification. I mean, in a way, the Buddhist practice, all like tonight, you know, having a late night vigil, you know, sitting for long periods of time, feeling sleepy or aching legs, aching back. You know, our trade is delayed gratification. In many respects, so I feel we do have a lot to offer in the very mode and spirit of our type of training is around this. But to consider, how can that be introduced? How can that element be introduced into the to the younger generation, to families, and to kids, to encourage that and help develop that capacity? So we learn to wait a little bit longer. We learn to put off the benefit a bit further into the future. We actually train ourselves to be more patient. We train ourselves to, ready to endure a little more difficulty, a little more of a burden, to see that if we do that, then the results are so much more beneficial down the line. So I've spoken a lot already. I thought it'd be more. It needed to be quite so anecdotal, but there were some interesting elements to this particular teaching tour, and its aspects of the world and life outside of the monastery. And these are things, even if you have no intention of ever going to Israel, that involved with Thailand or Thai politics, still these issues do map onto our own lives, and they are worthy of consideration. And so whatever amongst this narrative, these stories is useful for you, then please take that and use it. And whatever is beside the point or not interesting or useful, then please just put that aside.